Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to class. This is Bible 231. It's May 4th. We're going to finish up lymphatics in just a couple seconds and then move on to respiratory system. That's what our goal is today, respiratory system. So, let's go take a look at the schedule and see what's happening. We're getting toward the end here. We're really, really close. So, May 4th. Yep, we're going to get into respiratory system, and then we just have three more, digestive, urinary, and the diversification system. So today's the fourth, 1 week, 2 weeks, right, two and a half weeks is your last exam. That's going to be the fourth exam covering these chapters right here. So I think we're in really good shape. Don't forget that very last week, on the 18th or the 20th, you have your fourth practicum. So you got a lab this week and a lab next week, and then after that, then just a practicum. And I think the Monday group has to take a quiz that day as well. After the practicum, you can take a quiz, and then you'll have 10 quizzes all together. The Wednesday group, I think, has all the quizzes they need by the time they take the practicum. And I suppose that's fair, because the Wednesday group is going to get a practicum and a lecture exam, and no need to take another quiz on top of that on the same day. Okay, anybody have a question on the schedule at all? Chapters, any of that kind of stuff? Blackboard is working okay. I haven't looked at it in a while. I haven't heard any comments. Other than, unless it's fixed today, there's no way that I can email you. Email is not working in my gateway. Email is not working in Blackboard. And so that's probably the reason why I haven't been emailing you guys. So just come to class to get the latest discussion on what we're talking about and other kinds of details. All right, so all the lectures are online for you to listen to. Once again, I'll try and get this lecture on really soon, maybe a little bit later today. And don't forget, this week, hand protection, eye protection, and toe protection, because we're going to be doing fetal pig dissection this week and next week. And on the very last day of the practicum, you don't need that. You don't need gloves, eyeglasses, or shoes necessarily, because you won't be doing any dissection. Okay, so we got pretty much to, maybe tonsils, right? Maybe we talked about tonsils a little bit, but they contain mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue, like all the lymphatic tissue that we find around our intestines. They help fight infection. See, do I have? Oh, here's a pretty good view of the tonsils. The pharyngeal tonsil is above the oral cavity, posterior oral cavity. We have the palatine tonsils, and then underneath the tongue we have the sublingual tonsils. And it's kind of ironic, because sometimes, even though these things are there to fight infection, sometimes they can be chronically inflamed, and even with all kinds of courses of antibiotics that never clears up, somebody might get a sore throat every other week, at least maybe once a month, something like that. The sore throat might be really bad to where you miss work. And if that's the case, then you might elect to just have that tonsil or the pair of those tonsils removed. And in a child, that's not such a big surgery. Probably they're going to be eating ice cream the very next day or later on in the afternoon. But for an adult, that's actually a fairly serious surgery, because they pull out a hunk of tissue about as big as your fingertip, your little fingertip on either side of your throat, and so you're really sore. You probably won't even feel like eating ice cream for maybe 4 or 5 days, something like that. So you get two weeks off work. But you know what? That can change your life. Instead of having a sore throat once or twice a month, you might not get sick for a year. And so that's really amazing that that happens, right? That can certainly change your life. So those are the tonsils, right? Here they are, palatine, pharyngeal, lingual. And it's the palatine tonsils that are typically removed, but not necessarily, right? Typically, those are the ones that are removed. Okay, lymph nodes, a little bit more sophisticated structure than just malt, and because there's a reticular network of fibers that macrophages adhere to. And here's a really good lymph node. Okay, so here's a nice lymph node, kind of bean-shaped. And there are a bunch of lymphatic vessels that empty into a lymph node, and you can tell which way the lymph is flowing, not only because of these arrows, but because of the direction of these valves, right? So fluid can flow into a lymph node, but can't flow out. if it is an afferent lymph node. So I see a number of afferent lymph nodes, and I see just two efferent lymph nodes, lymph vessels, all right, leaving the lymph node. So I'm sorry, these are vessels, lymph vessels, afferent lymph vessels. All right, so lymph enters this node, and it just percolates around all of that reticular fiber and macrophages. And remember, a macrophage is a white blood cell that has left the circulatory system and is crawling around other spaces inside your body, in this particular case, a lymph node, and it's there to fight infection, right? So it will notice foreign objects, foreign antigens, and then with the help of the rest of the immune system, come up with some kind of process to kill whatever that infection is, right? So that's the job of those macrophages. So these are all different sinuses. Sinuses just means that there's a network of reticular fibers, and attached to those reticular fibers are macrophages, and this lymph just kind of flows through all of these different spaces, right? So even though we have a subcapsular sinus and a cortical sinus and a medullary sinus, they're all pretty much doing the same kind of thing. Lymph is just trickling through these spaces and then eventually out an efferent vessel. And remember, when lymph returns back to a subclavian, it has to pass through, or it does pass through at least one lymph node. In most cases, many more than one. All right. So, remember, afferent, okay, is bringing lymph into a node, and efferent is taking lymph away from a node. And you can tell the direction of flow from these vessels right there. Okay, some other things that fight infection. Oh, I guess there's something else I want to say about a lymph node right here. Okay, because of those macrophages and other lymphatic cells in a lymph node, if a bacteria does enter, right, or some kind of infectious particle, maybe a virus, could be bacteria, right, that's going to activate the immune system, right? And so those things are what we call antigens. Just by the shape of a bacteria or by the shape of certain molecules on the surface of a bacteria, the cells can tell it doesn't belong to your body. Right? So when a foreign antigen enters this area, then the immune system becomes activated, and that causes proliferation of lymph cells. And proliferation just means that these cells are undergoing mitosis. So instead of one, you got two. And then instead of two, you got four. And all these cells will fight the infection. And so when there is an infection, sometimes these lymph nodes do swell up because of activation of the immune system in what we call germinal centers. Right? So here we have a germinal center. A germinal center is responsible for immune system activation. Okay. Activation of the immune system. Yep, is proliferation. So don't forget, proliferation is when you have mitosis taking place. Right? Start with one, then two, then four, then 8, 16, and things grow exponentially as a result of that. Okay, the spleen. Look at that. Here's that nice reticular fibers with macrophages attached to it within the sinus of a lymph node, right? And lymph just passes through all these structures. Okay, what about a spleen? So here is a spleen. In lab, you're going to see a spleen today or on Wednesday. It's lateral and posterior to the stomach. It kind of curls right around the Gravert curvature of the stomach. And just like a lymph node, the connective tissue is reticular connective tissue. And how strong is reticular connective tissue that holds this organ together? It's extremely weak. Yeah, it's extremely weak. So the spleen can be easily damaged, but it is important because there's different kinds of pulp. Here is red pulp, and here is white pulp. And red pulp is responsible for filtering blood, right? And red pulp can also store some red blood cells. And when blood percolates through this area right here, old and damaged red blood cells are removed and broken down in the spleen. So that's the job of red pulp. White pulp, on the other hand, doesn't filter blood. It filters lymph, pretty much like a lymph node. And there can be germinal centers within the spleen. The immune system can be activated by white pulp to fight an infection if you ever have an infection. All right, so we said that when a spleen is damaged because it just has reticular fibers, maybe due to some kind of trauma, it can't be sutured back together because those fibers just aren't strong enough. So if this part of the spleen is damaged, then this blood vessel and this artery and this vein have to be tied off, right? And then this whole part of the spleen has to be removed. And if there's a lot of damage to the spleen, sometimes the whole spleen has to be removed, right? Just to prevent massive hemorrhage from occurring. So you might ask, well, gee whiz, what happens to somebody if they don't have their spleen? Are they more susceptible to infection? Well, where did we say we would find the immune system? Where would we find lymphatic organs? Right, you have tonsils, you got all those lymph nodes, you have malt associated with every kind of mucosal lining in your organs, right? So you have so much immune tissue, lymphatic tissue everywhere in your body that it really doesn't matter if you're going to lose a spleen. Oh, another good example would be the appendix. There's lymphatic tissue that fights infection, and people get their appendix removed all the time, and they're not really more susceptible to infection. Because why? Because we have lymphatic tissue pretty much all over our body to fight infection. And that's probably one of the most important organ systems in our body, right, is our immune system, just to fight infection, just to keep our bodies nice and healthy. Okay. There's only one case that I can think of when somebody has a spleen removed, right? Not for appendix, not for a tonsil, but for a spleen, because there is so much lymphatic tissue, that a person might be more susceptible to a side effect of any kind of surgery, right? And I don't know if people have ever had family members that had surgery, but there's one thing that everybody pays attention to right after surgery, and that is infection, right? So somebody after surgery might be a little bit more prone to infection if they have a splenectomy, and especially if that surgery includes the placement of some kind of prosthesis, like maybe a metal suture or a clip to clip off a blood vessel or a hip to replace a hip, metal pieces that go in there, or a knee, then you really have to consider what some of the consequences might be and pay really close attention to what's going on. So there might be a couple of rare circumstances when somebody is missing a spleen that you have to be concerned about, but day in and day out, it's not much of a concern. Okay, and then lastly, the thymus gland. That's in the mediastinum. I showed you where that was, and that's a special lymphatic organ. Here's a nice view of it, right, just superior to the heart. And this is where a certain kind of lymphocyte goes. And do you remember what a lymphocyte looks like from lab? It's a white blood cell. It was really nice and circular, which means it's spherical, and the nucleus took up almost the whole inside of the cell, and the nucleus was nice and smooth and spherical as well. All right, so those are very important for fighting infection. You have two kinds, B lymphocytes and T lymphocytes. Guess which one goes to the thymus gland to gain competency, to mature? The T, that's right, that's how it got its name. Okay. And T lymphocytes wander around your body looking for antigens. And remember, antigens are just those little signposts on the cell membrane of bacteria and viruses and other kind of cells. And if they find something that doesn't belong in your body, they'll bind to that cell and then break that cell apart. Right, so the T lymphocyte is what we call a contact killer. It has to bump into a cell, contact killer. The other kind of lymphocyte, which we don't have to know about in this class, but you're going to hear about pretty soon in other classes, is a B lymphocyte, and a B lymphocyte produces antibodies, other chemicals that are secreted into the blood, and those chemicals then can destroy foreign cells that are in your body, right? So that the B lymphocyte itself doesn't have to contact the antigen, but it produces antibodies that can. All right, so that's the thymus gland. Okay, yeah, questions? The red blood cell reservoir is in red pulp, in spleen, so that if somebody hemorrhages, the spleen can contribute red blood cells to blood, so that counteracts, right, that hemorrhage. And I've not known anybody to run into a circumstance where if they have a splenectomy, that they're more susceptible to hemorrhage. If it's so great, at least here in the United States, they'll be transfused, right? Okay, so that's it for lymphatic system. Okay, just look at all this lymphatic tissue all over the body, and this doesn't even show lymph nodes. Okay, so I think we can put this away. Do you want to save changes? Okay, I'm not so sure I do or not, but let's save them. All right, so now we're going to move on to respiratory system. Yes, I have a respiratory system. And some of you have been studying for your lab quizzes. So you're kind of familiar with some of these structures. I hope everybody looked at material for their lab quiz already, because it will make a whole lot more sense. All right, so respiratory system, I think we all have a pretty good sense of what that is. First, it's for moving air in and out of our bodies. And when air moves in, we extract oxygen out of it. That oxygen is real important for making ATP. And in the process, our bodies produce CO2, so when we exhale, we're exhaling that CO2. All right, so inhalation brings in a nutrient we need. Exhalation removes a waste product from our body. So moving air in and out of the lungs is what we call ventilation. That's an important part of the respiratory system. Okay, another function, of course, once we get air in our lungs, that oxygen has to move by diffusion from the air inside of our lungs into our blood. So gas exchange between air in the lungs and blood, that's a very important function. And then transport of oxygen and CO2 in the blood. The solubility of oxygen and carbon dioxide are drastically different. Carbon dioxide has a tendency to dissolve in plasma all by itself, but oxygen does not like to do that. So evolution has figured out a way how our blood can carry a lot of oxygen, since oxygen doesn't like to dissolve in blood. And that is that you have a certain kind of cell. What kind of cell? Anybody know what kind of cell carries oxygen for us in our blood? And it is the red blood cell, right? The red blood cell doesn't even have room for organelles inside of it. It's completely loaded with a chemical called hemoglobin. And oxygen loves to bind to hemoglobin. Hemoglobin has an iron atom associated with it, and oxygen likes to associate with that iron atom. And there are four of those heme groups in every hemoglobin. So for every little hemoglobin, it can carry four oxygen molecules. So transport of oxygen and CO2 is important. And you'll become a lot more familiar with these processes in a physiology class, but this is an important function. And then the last important function is, right, even though we get air into our blood, right, there's exchange in our lungs, that oxygen has to get into our tissues, right? So the exchange of oxygen that's in blood with our tissues is also important. So gas exchange, again, between blood and tissues. All right, so number two, gas exchange. Number four, gas exchange, going in different directions. All right, but what kind of blood vessel is going to be involved with the process number two and number four? Okay, but a tissue, I heard red blood cell, that's the kind of cell for oxygen that's very important. Okay, CO2, sort of, but not as important. But what kind of blood vessel? Yeah, capillary allows for exchange, right? A capillary allows for exchange. Okay, well, let's move on to some anatomy. The upper respiratory tract includes the nose, the narrow nasopharynx, oropharynx, laryngopharynx, nasal cavity, and the pharynx. Well, what the heck are these things? Well, let's see if we can find some of these things on this nice illustration. So here we see the respiratory tract, right, starting with the nose, ending up with the lungs. And if we look carefully, I can see an oral cavity right here, and behind the oral cavity is what we call the pharynx. So here is the pharynx, and we were just talking about when somebody gets an infection of the pharynx, when their tonsils are chronically inflamed. Does anybody remember what I said about an infection when somebody has chronically infected tonsils? What do you get? A sore throat. That's right. So what the pharynx is just a nice scientific name for throat. So when you have a sore throat, that is what we call a pharyngitis. A pharyngitis is a sore throat because that's your pharynx. Well, you see there's a couple It's kind of a long area. The pharynx that is up by your nasal cavity is called the nasopharynx. The one that's just behind your oral cavity is called the oropharynx. And then the one that's behind this windpipe over here, this is what we call the laryngopharynx. So a pharynx can contain air as well as food that we eat, right? It can have multiple purposes. But the airway itself, right, should only have air, should never have food. Okay, so these are the structures that make up the upper respiratory tract, nasal cavity, and remember you see these shelves in there. These are made by the nasal conchae, okay, the oral cavity, pharynx. And then we run into some structures that have cartilage around them. And let's see if we can zoom into this area a little bit. Okay, yeah, your nose has some cartilage. We're not so... Oh, here's a nice picture of the nasopharynx, oropharynx, and laryngopharynx. Okay, so let's go to... Oh, this is a nice illustration. It's an exam figure, but it's also for the quiz and lab this week. Okay, so here is the oral cavity, and here's a nice tongue, right? When you eat something, food slides over the tongue, through the fauces, and then finally into the pharynx, and it should end up in your stomach. We haven't talked about this yet, but does anybody know the name of the tube that takes food into your stomach that you swallow? It is on this illustration, and indeed, you're right. It is the esophagus, right? Now, when we breathe air in either through our oral cavity or nasal cavity, air doesn't go down into the stomach, right? It goes into your lungs. So air has to take a little detour and enter what we call the larynx, right? So here is the larynx, and all these little blue structures represent cartilage, and you can palpate your larynx right here. Kind of sometimes we call that the voice box. Right, so that is your larynx. That's the beginning of the lower respiratory tract. Right. And then the tube that takes air from the larynx down to your lungs, that's not the esophagus, that is the trachea. That's the trachea. Okay, which tube, esophagus or trachea, is posterior? Esophagus is posterior, right? And so the tube that's anterior is the trachea, and so when we start doing dissections in lab, we're going to make an incision on this anterior part of the neck, and what are we going to run into first, trachea or esophagus? Yeah, the trachea. We're going to run into trachea first, and that's going to be really obvious because we'll see all these cartilaginous rings around the trachea that are holding it open. And if you want to find the esophagus, where do you find the esophagus if you know where the trachea is? Yeah, just right smack behind it. Don't have to look very far. Matter of fact, with a nice blunt probe, you can separate these two tubes out from each other very easily. Right? So esophagus is going to be posterior. Okay, so here is that larynx. It's got a number of different kinds of cartilages. And again, that was part of the quiz for this week in lab. And here is a nice anterior view of the larynx as well as some tracheal cartilages. I think this is a good place to start talking about it. The cartilage that sticks out that's easily palpated is called the thyroid cartilage because associated anterior to that and maybe just a little bit below is the thyroid gland, which maybe you could palpate. It's not a very tough gland, but I think you could probably palpate it. And then underneath it, there's another ring that completely goes around the larynx. That's the cricoid cartilage. And although this thyroid cartilage looks really big, it doesn't completely go all the way around the larynx. And when we look at a posterior view, we're going to see that the cricoid cartilage actually is bigger, right, than the thyroid cartilage. Right. You're familiar with this bone. What is this bone right here? Is that a mandible? It is not. It is a hyoid bone, right? And so that assists with swallowing, assists with breathing and articulation as well. Okay, so this upper airway has these cartilages, and the trachea has cartilages around it. And your airways need these cartilages to hold an airway open all the time. Okay, let's talk about why that is. Why does an airway have to be held open with these cartilages all the time? All the time. Okay, it's important for breathing. Why is that? Why is it important for breathing? It's easy to get air in our lungs, but to get air out of our lungs, we have to compress our thorax, right? We have to compress our thorax. And when we compress our thorax, if this was just a tube like the esophagus, it would compress as well. It would become occluded, right? And if it was just like the esophagus, when you compress your chest and the trachea becomes occluded, then you couldn't get air out of your lungs, right? And if you can't get air out of your lungs, you can't get any new air going in, right? So these things have to be held open all the time, no matter what the pressure is inside the thorax. These things are held open so that air can flow nice and easily through these different passageways. Okay, all right. And in a second, we're going to talk about what are some of the clinical ramifications of that. Well, here's a nice sagittal section. We've cut open the trachea and the larynx. All right, here's that cricoid cartilage. Here's the thyroid cartilage. Now you can get an impression of what their relative size is. And there's some other cartilages that I want you to be familiar with as well. Okay, so this one right here is called the arytenoid cartilage. There's some skeletal muscles associated with the arytenoid cartilage. And the arytenoid cartilage is also attached to some vocal cords. And those muscles attached to the arytenoid can put more or less tension on these vocal cords, and that can change the pitch of your voice. Right, so you can have a really high pitch or really low pitch voice just by adjusting the tension on these vocal cords. And when air passes over them, actually air that's leaving the lungs, then that's what causes these things to vibrate and that produces sound. So arytenoid cartilage is, here's that nice arytenoid muscle that I just talked about. Here is a cartilage that you don't have to know, I don't believe, right? The corniculate, it's just a tiny piece of cartilage right on top of the arytenoids. But you do have to know something in lab about this cuneiform cartilage, which we can just barely see on this particular illustration. And then, so all the cartilages that we've talked about so far are just nice hyaline cartilage, but there's a special one that's made out of elastic, and I haven't mentioned it yet. And it is on this illustration, and it is labeled, right? And it's a trapdoor that comes down over the opening of the larynx when we swallow something. And it's called the trapdoor is called the epiglottis, right? Epi just means on top. A glottis is just a hole. It's not a structure that I can point to, but it's just a hole that's an entrance for material to enter the larynx, right? So like the pupil is not really a structure. What is the pupil? It's really just a hole, right? So the glottis is just a hole in the larynx that things can enter. All right, well, don't forget, these airways are held open all the time, and that can be dangerous, because all you have to do is grab something, put it in right here at the glottis, and let go, and where is it going to end up? Yeah, it's going to drop right through the glottis into the larynx or trachea, or maybe even further down into the respiratory pathway, and now you have this object that's stuck in the trachea, and then what is your concern then? Yeah, but you can't breathe, right? So breathing is a really good thing to get oxygen in your body. We call that choking, right? So the epiglottis prevents choking under most circumstances. And if somebody has an occluded airway or they're choking, they can't ask for help because they can't get air to flow over the vocal cords. So the vocal cords are not going to vibrate. And so I think everybody should know what the sign is, the sign language for choking, so that you can tell somebody, right, that you're not breathing and you're going to die really soon unless you get some help. And that is, people were showing me already, right, it's hands like that across the neck. Okay. All right, well, you know what? This epiglottis gets lazy on a particular day of the week. And it's even at a particular time on that day the epiglottis gets lazy. And those of you that know CPR probably know this or should be aware of that time, so that if you're around some other people or out in public, you know when to really just kind of pay attention and not freak out if all of a sudden somebody starts choking and turning blue on you. So what day of the week does this epiglottis get lazy? It doesn't like to protect the opening. It doesn't like to protect the glottis, and food can enter right here into the trachea, get stuck. What day of the week is that? Anybody? Nobody's offering a suggestion right away. Okay, so I'll have to tell you. And when I tell you the day, you'll probably be able to tell me the time. Okay, it's usually on a Friday. Not Monday morning before the quiz in the anatomy lab. Okay, that's not the time, but it's Friday. What time on Friday? like 5 p.m. and I heard some people laughing. That's right. It's always associated or usually associated with adult beverage, right? And you're out having a good time, maybe with some colleagues from work or some colleagues from school. Maybe you guys from anatomy get together and study in the afternoon and then go out for some nachos or popcorn shrimp or something, right? You're sitting around the table, sharing a couple pitchers of beer, and then you start talking about your anatomy structure, and somebody says, oh yeah, our anatomy structure does such and such a thing, and then just as you're about ready to swallow, right, they say something like that, and you start to laugh, and what do you do before, right before you laugh? You go, inhale, okay, and there goes that nacho right into the airway, okay? So the take-home story there is, don't tell any jokes about your anatomy structure, okay, because you might choke to death. That would be terrible if that were to happen. Okay, so Friday nights and also Saturday nights probably is the second most frequent time where people choke. And it's usually, like I said, associated with adult beverage and a really good joke, right? And their popcorn shrimp goes right into the airway. All right, so this is the importance of the cartilages, but also some of the trade-offs, because the tube is open all the time and things can fall right in there, right, and cause choking to happen. All right, so what did we miss so far? Well, we're doing pretty good with lower respiratory tract in terms of the larynx anyway. And the trachea. Ah, trachea. We look at the trachea a lot when we were doing our microscopy in lab, okay, because it has a really nice epithelium. What's the job of an epithelium, once again? What's the job of an epithelium? What is an epithelium? I heard something really good. An epithelium? What's on your skin? What's on the surface of your body? The epidermis, and the epidermis is what? Stratified squamous epithelium. So that kind of gives you a hint of what an epithelium does. So tell me what a epithelium is. It covers the surface or lines a cavity, right? And it can become a membrane if we put some connective tissue in there with the epithelium. Okay, so here is the lining of the trachea. On this picture, this is a nice transverse, nice transverse section of the trachea. And then here's the esophagus. We got a lot of slides. Some people have looked at slides in lab just like this already. Not from a person, but from a little, probably a mouse or something, so it was small. All right, so here's the trachea. It's held open. The cartilage doesn't completely encircle the trachea. Right, it doesn't go posterior all the way across the back. It's just the sides and this anterior portion. Right, because if it completely circled the trachea, it would bulge out into the esophagus, and that would impede swallowing. You wouldn't be able to swallow very well. Right, so when you swallow a bolus of food through the esophagus, it can bulge out into the trachea just a little bit, so that bolus of food actually can enter the stomach. So here is a little trachealis muscle that attaches to the two ends of the cartilage, and sometimes this cartilage we call a horseshoe-shaped cartilage, because it doesn't completely go around. Well, what I wanted to talk about was the epithelium. And we can kind of see what the epithelium, there's a hint as to what the epithelium is. Okay. Yeah, it was one of those. And I see cilia. Yeah, I can see cilia. You couldn't see them if this was just your naked eye, right? You would need a microscope to see it. But it's a pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. And so it's an epithelium that lines a cavity that's open to the outside world. What kind of membrane lines a cavity that's open to the outside world? It's got a general class. A mucous membrane, right on. So in this particular mucous membrane, if we were to look, right, and let's see if we can look in a nice microscopic fashion. Oh, here's probably the very next slide. This is nice. Right, so here is some of that hyaline tracheal cartilage. Then we have some submucosa. Then here is the epithelium, and you can see the columnar shape of these cells. And this is a really nice picture because I can see some cilia. And then if I look even further, I see this cell right here. It's not labeled. This is a goblet cell. And the job of a goblet cell is to secrete mucus onto the surface. Right, and what's the job of these cilia? Yeah, movement, you could say motility is a really good thing. They're sweeping in the same direction. And the mucus from this goblet cell traps dust particles and bacteria and all kinds of stuff that we don't want in our lungs. So where do these cilia sweep? Do they sweep in the direction toward your lungs or toward your oral cavity? Yeah, up out of your body, into your oral cavity, right? So now you have all this mucus and debris in your oral cavity, then what do you do with it? Unless you're a baseball player, then you can spit it out. But usually it's more appropriate to just swallow it down, right? Get it into your stomach, out of your airways, into your stomach, and that protects your lungs to a large degree. Just a mechanical protection of your lungs from infection. All right, so this is a pretty special, really fun epithelium to look at. Okay, so that's pretty much the trachea. All right, so air is still flowing. Let's take a look where air is flowing. It's pretty good picture. All right, so air flows through your nasal cavity or oral cavity into the pharynx, then a detour in past the glottis into the trachea. Then down here, the trachea ends. It bifurcates. And it bifurcates into something we call a bronchus. So here is the left main bronchus. Here's the right main bronchus. And I can notice that the left main bronchus comes off at a more of an angle compared to the right main. And if I look even a little bit more closely, the left lung is not as big as the right lung. Who could maybe give me an explanation why that is? Yeah, because here is your myocardium. What's another name for myocardium? Here is your heart, right? So it takes up some space in the left part of the thoracic cavity, so the left lung is a little bit smaller. This main bronchus going to a smaller lung can be smaller, and it comes off more at an angle because the heart is there. So when somebody is choking and something falls in all the way to the bottom of the trachea, it's much more likely to fall into the right main bronchus rather than the left because it's bigger, number one, and it's less of an angle to get in there. And as a matter of fact, if your last resort is, before somebody dies because you can't clear an airway, what is your last resort when somebody has something stuck in a trachea? What's the last resort to do? If you can't do a Heimlich maneuver to get that thing expelled out of their trachea, then the best thing is to try to pressurize, right, their trachea and try to move that particle either into one of these bronchus, and then you would have at least one lung working. Okay, so that's like the very last thing you would want to try. All right, so let's take a look at these bronchi. Here's a pretty good view. All right, so here's the trachea, here's the right, here's the left main bronchus, and then after it enters the lung, right, it's going to bifurcate again. So the main bronchus sometimes is called a primary. After that first bifurcation, it's called a secondary, then it bifurcates again into a tertiary, and it keeps bifurcating, right, till it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. But what about all these different bronchi? What is similar that all these bronchi have similar to the trachea? I can see it on this slide. Can you analyze this? Rings. It has cartilage. That's right. It has cartilage. So bronchus is held open all the time with that cartilage, no matter what kind of bronchus it is. Okay, so here I also see that the right lung has three lobes, right? It's superior, middle, and inferior. And the left lung only has kind of reminds me of a thumb, only has a superior and inferior, right? Because the thumb only has two phalanges on it. All right, so that's a pretty good picture for the lungs. Okay, when it gets into a microscopic tube, we're going to call that a bronchiole. And let's see if we can find a bronchiole. A bronchiole no longer has cartilage around it. All right, so here I see a bronchiole, and I see it illustrated on this lung. But, of course, you would need a microscope to see these things, so it's not really drawn to scale. And here I have some smooth muscle. No longer do we have cartilage, but we have some smooth muscle. And that smooth muscle can contract, right? And it can constrict these bronchioles. And when these are constricted, then that reduces the amount of airflow through these particular spaces, right? Through these different bronchioles. And if that's inappropriate, then we just call that bronchospasm, and it's very difficult for people to breathe. Sometimes inhalation, sometimes if there's damage to these bronchioles, it's very hard for them to exhale. Right? And again, remember, if you can't exhale, then you can't inhale either. Right? So either way you go. Okay, so here is a bronchiole. There's going to be a small branch off a bronchiole that we call a terminal bronchiole. And you know that it's not a bronchus because there's no cartilage. And then I see some of these little bubbles all over the place. These are nice spherical sacs that we call alveoli. And around an alveolus, there is a network of capillaries. So what's happening around this alveolus? Exchange. That's right. So oxygen is going into the blood and CO2 is leaving the blood. And so when I see an alveolus right here kind of stuck all by itself on a bronchiole, right, then we're going to call this a respiratory bronchiole, because what's happening even on this bronchiole? Exchange is happening because of this alveolus. Okay, but most of the exchange happens in these alveolar sacs, which are groups of alveoli, and there's even passageways, little pores between the various alveoli. All right, so let's see if we can get into, oh, here's a really nice cross-section of an alveolar sac. All right, so here is a respiratory bronchiole up over here that leads into an alveolar duct, which then brings air into these alveoli, and they all have pores, so that air can fill up all of these different spaces. All right. Now, do you notice something special on the surface of an alveolus? Do you see anything on this illustration? You got to tell me what color it is. Yellow? Brown? Yeah, this crisscross of material right here. Okay, that is elastic fibers. Okay, elastic fibers, that's really important. Because when we inhale, we inflate all of these alveoli and they expand, right? And then when we relax the muscles for inspiration, what do these elastic fibers do? They contract, and that helps force air out of our lungs. That forces air out of the alveoli. So these elastic fibers are very important for expiration. Okay, here's a pretty good illustration that shows everything that we're interested in. All right, so here I see an alveolar sac, another alveolar sac, and some things have been separated. I see elastic fibers on the one on the left, and then this one right here in the middle. There are elastic fibers there, they just haven't been drawn in, but now I see that network of capillaries, right, for exchange. All right, and then I see a nice blue blood vessel right here. Tell me the name of this blue blood vessel. It is a pulmonary artery. I hope you said artery. Are you sure, even though it's blue? Yes, because this is taking blood away from the heart to the lungs to pick up oxygen. When it picks up oxygen, then it's drawn in as a red color. And then here's a vessel bringing blood back to the heart, this red blood vessel, and this is a pulmonary vein, right? So, you're going to have to make some mistakes with that before it really crystallizes in your mind what's a pulmonary artery, pulmonary vein by color. Hopefully, you'll make enough mistakes before the practicum or before the lecture exam. I mean, there's just something weird about how you got to switch your point of view between the systemic and pulmonary circulations, right? Okay. All right. Well, maybe I made a big enough deal to where it will, even when you're under a lot of stress taking a test, it will just, the right answers will pop into your mind. Okay, well, there's about 300 million of these alveoli. Okay, about 300 million, where do I have? Do I have that written down someplace? Let me see if I have it written down. Make sure I'm quoting. Yeah, 300 million alveoli. And I want to talk about these alveoli right now. All right, so they're surrounded with these capillaries. And if we were to take an alveolus, right, and kind of peel it like an orange and lay it flat on a table, right, like this table right here, how big would that table have to be? Right, we're going to come up with a number for that. And what does that really signify? Right, that's the surface area for exchange. Right, so what do I mean by surface area for exchange? I'm going to turn the light on. Right, don't let me do this again if I've done it already, but I'm not sure I have. Okay. What's the surface area of this door right over here? how would we measure surface area of this door? It's the width of the door times the height of the door. Multiply those two numbers together, and that would give us the surface area. All right, so here I have a meter stick. So let's go ahead and measure this doorway right here. So if we look at the width, it is, wow, look at that. So it's exactly 1 meter. That's pretty amazing. I don't know why that is. Probably code someplace. All right, so remember 1 meter, but we also got to measure the height. All right, so what's the height? Here's 1 meter, right? Here's 1 meter. And then here is, all right, I want to be really precise about this. Okay, here is, oh, exactly 2 meters. That's wonderful. Because now we know what the surface area is. It is what? Exactly 2 square meters. 1 times 2 is 2 square meters. All right, so what's the function of this doorway right here? What's that function of that doorway? Maybe not right now, but eventually, what are we going to do with that doorway? Yeah, we're going to enter or leave the room. So what's the process that's happening there? Exchange. That's right. So when you think of surface area, okay, a doorway, right, I want you to think of exchange. When I say surface area for exchange, what do you want to think of? A doorway, okay? And as the doorway gets bigger, what can you tell me about exchange? How many people can fit through this doorway at one time? Well, 1 easy, 2, 3, 4 maybe if they get a running start from the top of the room, right, and come running down and get through here all at the same time. So just less than a handful. Now, let's switch this door out and make it a garage door. How many people can get through a garage door at one time? 40, maybe 50, a lot more people, right? So as the doorway gets bigger, what happens to exchange? It goes up, right? And we say it's directly related. So as the doorway gets bigger, exchange gets bigger, and the surface area in your lungs, if we were to take all 300 million of those alveoli and flatten them out on a table, okay, and what's a good way to think of surface area for exchange as a doorway? Yeah, as a doorway. So what's the doorway for exchange in your lungs if we were going to flatten all 300 million of those alveoli? We won't do that in lab. It's going to be half of a tennis court, okay? So not the whole length of a tennis court, but you would be as wide as a tennis court and half as tall. And I can't imagine why I would like to be like that, okay, as wide as a tennis court. So fortunately, what has happened to that doorway? It's all been folded up into these little sacks so that they fit into our lungs. So that's pretty handy. All right, so that alveolus has that shape. It's specialized for exchange, and the doorway is, it's huge. I think in here I have 80 square meters. Is that what I have down over here? 70 square meters. Okay, it's between 60 and 80, okay, which is 70. Okay, all right, so that's the doorway for exchange. Let's continue looking at some of these alveoli. Here's a nice illustration of an alveolus. Right, and there is an epithelium that makes the alveolus. Can anybody remember what kind of epithelium is specialized for exchange? Yeah, just a simple squamous epithelium, right? Just a really thin, flat cell, which we say squamous, and just one layer, because diffusion can only work through very small spaces. So I see some cells, some small pancake-shaped cells that make up the alveolus. Inside the alveolus, I see a macrophage. These are the same kind of cells that we found in lymph nodes and spleen, right? They're there to identify antigens, infectious particles, and then bring that to the rest of the immune system so that the rest of the immune system can come up with some kind of strategy to kill that particular particle. Like the B lymphocytes produce antibodies. The T lymphocytes become contact killers, right? Because they get information from this macrophage. And here is a nice capillary, really close to the alveolus. There's only a really small interstitial space between them. And what can you tell me about the wall of a capillary? What kind of epithelium is that? That's a simple squamous epithelium, right? But since it's lining that tube, we call it an endothelium. Okay. All right, well, let's look at something we call the respiratory membrane. The respiratory membrane is just a structure that oxygen has to diffuse across One is going from air in the alveolus into the blood. What does oxygen actually have to move across? Or what does carbon dioxide have to move across to go from blood into the air? Well, here is the respiratory membrane. Okay? And what do I see? I see the wall of the alveolus. That's one component. I see a very small interstitial space. And then I see the wall of the capillary. That's the whole membrane that's separating air and blood. And that's a very, very thin membrane. So you're probably getting an impression how delicate lung tissue is, right? Not only does it have all those elastic fibers, which can be damaged pretty easily, but look at this respiratory membrane, right? It's just microscopic. It's actually submicroscopic. And your lung is probably one of the most delicate organs in your body because of this respiratory membrane. And you don't want to get rid of this respiratory membrane because then what happens? Then you need a lung transplant. Okay? That's not good. Nobody elects to have that. Okay, there are a couple different kinds of cells besides that simple squamous, right? The simple squamous is what we call a type 1 alveolar cell, but here's one that's a little bit thicker. This is a type 2 alveolar cell, right? And I want to talk about that for a second. All right, so think of water because there's water, right? There's water inside your body. Then these alveoli are really nice and humid, and there's a little water coating on the inside of this alveolus. But what can you tell me about water? Is it slippery or is it sticky? I hear slippery and sticky. I tried to trick you guys, but some people said sticky. And guess what? You're absolutely right. All right, so this is really shocking, right, when I first learned about it. Water is not slippery. Maybe if it's on the tile floor and you step on it, it can be a little bit slippery. But water all by itself, right, is really sticky. It acts like a glue. As a matter of fact, there are some animals that can walk right on the surface of water. Anybody see, like, an animal walk right on the surface of water? Like a water bug or an insect, water spider, okay? And it can walk on the surface of water because water molecules stick together. It has a certain kind of bond called a hydrogen bond. It will be a really big deal when you get into physiology. So water molecules get stuck together, so something that's very light can't even break those bonds and fall into the water. So that force that's holding water molecules together is called surface tension. Right? So water has a property called surface tension because water likes to stick together. So if there is water on one side of the alveolus and water on the other side of the alveolus and these walls touch each other, what happens? They get glued together because of that water or surface tension. And of course, that would be terrible because this alveolus can't inflate. You can't get air in. You can't get oxygen into your body, right? And then you just suffocate when that happens. So the purpose of these type 2 alveolar cells is to secrete something that's really slippery. It's almost like a detergent. And it stops that surface tension. It breaks surface tension down so that the walls of the alveolus don't stick together. Right? They become really slippery. That substance is called surfactant. Surfactant secreting cell. Type 2 is a surfactant secreting cell. And I didn't bring in, we're just really busy with dissection, so I didn't bring in some nice little experiments. But hopefully next time, Wednesday, we'll do a couple experiments concerning this alveolus right here. Okay, and sometimes people don't secrete surfactant. Maybe a newborn baby, a premature baby, these cells aren't mature enough to secrete surfactant. So what happens to their lung function then? It's way depressed, but they still need oxygen. So what do we do for a premature baby whose lungs haven't developed enough to inflate properly? Yeah, put them in an incubator where there's really high oxygen concentration, and so it's easier for oxygen to enter their bodies, right? There's a bigger concentration gradient or concentration difference between the air in that incubator and the oxygen, or the oxygen in the incubator and the oxygen that's inside that little baby's body. Okay, there are some trade-offs to that. Maybe in lab we can talk about some of that. Okay, so that was the respiratory zone. Right, the respiratory bronchial. What does a respiratory bronchial have? Let's see if we can refresh our memory. What does it have? A respiratory bronchial. It has It has smooth muscle. What about cartilage? No cartilage. And it's got another special structure. It has, sticking right off the side, it has an alveolus, or maybe a couple of them joined together. Okay? And that respiratory bronchiole then brings air right into that alveolar sac. Okay. All right, so we talked about those elastic fibers. That's important. The respiratory membrane, these macrophages, the pores for equalizing pressure so that all the alveoli inflate in an alveolar sac, type 2 cells. Yeah, so we covered this zone pretty well. Okay, but look it over and ask me some questions about that next time if you have any questions. Let me find another figure. Where is another figure? Ah, I bet this is a good one right here. Indeed it is. Okay, so the inside of your lung is open to the outside world, right? So the trachea has a mucous membrane, and it's just kind of nice because this particular mucous membrane actually does secrete mucus because of those goblet cells, right? So the inside of your respiratory tract, including the lungs, is covered with a mucous membrane. But the outside of the lungs that I see right here is not open to the outside world. What kind of membrane lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world? Yeah, it's a little bit more complicated, right? It's that serous membrane. And if you think serous membrane, how many components does it have? It's got two is pretty close. I like to think of it as three. Okay, so let's take a look at what these three layers are. There's a membrane. Yeah, the serous membrane. There is a lining right on the surface of this organ and this lung, right? So that's an organ. It's deep inside a body cavity, so we call this a visceral organ, right? And the membrane that's right on this visceral organ is called the visceral serous membrane. And since it's around the lungs, we call it a pleural membrane, right? So here's the visceral pleural membrane. Are we zoomed in enough so that you can see where it is? It's touching the surface of the lung. Okay, and then there's going to be a space. We're going to get back to that space in a second. Here is another part of that membrane. It's not touching the lung. It's actually on the wall of the thorax, right here. So we can't call this the visceral pleura. This is what we call the parietal pleura, right? Because the visceral pleura is right on the surface of the lung. These two things, these two layers, really are exactly the same, because if we were to follow the visceral pleura all the way up where it ends, we would see that it just folds back on itself. It just folds back, right? So the parietal pleura and visceral pleura are really the same membrane. They're in just two different locations, and so we got to give them two different names. And then here's that space. We call that the pleural cavity, and there's not much of a space there in the lungs. It pretty much, we call it a potential space. Usually these membranes, the visceral and parietal pleura, are touching each other, right? So the space really isn't there. Unless you have an inflammation, if you have an infection or if there's damage to the lungs or to the thorax wall, then there can be a space right here. Anybody know what that's called when you have an infection of this pleural space? It's called pleurisy. Yeah, it's pleurisy. Hopefully nobody ever gets pleurisy because you're really uncomfortable. Whenever you try to take a breath, when you have pleurisy, it's like somebody has a big knife and they stab you in the chest. So maybe you can imagine what that feels like. What would that feel like? Horrible, really bad, right? Horrible, horrible, horrible. So that's when you inhale. You feel horrible. You feel like people are stabbing you in the chest with these big knives. So you have a tendency to hold your breath. Well, how do you feel when you hold your breath for 30 seconds or 40 seconds? That doesn't feel wonderful either, right? So you have a choice. You can feel like you're suffocating, or you can feel like somebody's stabbing you in the chest with a knife. What is your choice? Well, neither are very good choices, right? So somebody with pleurisy is miserable. They can't breathe, right? So what do we do? What can we do for somebody that's in that severe pain? Severe pain like that. What's a treatment for severe intractable pain? Hypnosis, maybe meditation, something like that, but chances are you're not going to get their attention. It is, somebody maybe said over here, yeah, medication would be opiates, right? Some pain medication, some painkillers. And this person will like owe you for the rest of their lives because now they can breathe again, right? So that's really wonderful. So there is, it doesn't have to be a drug seeker or drug abuser for opiates, but here's a particularly good example of why somebody should be on opiates, right? It will allow them to breathe without excruciating pain. And then, of course, you got to treat why somebody has pleurisy to begin with. Maybe it's viral, can't do much. Bacterial, yeah, then you can give antibiotics, for instance, right? And in the meantime, and as a matter of fact, if they're in so much pain that they really can't breathe even with opiates, then what do you have to do for them? Think of that premature baby. You put them in an oxygen tent, right? There's not an incubator for adults like this, but an oxygen tent, and that will help exchange of oxygen into their body as well. All right, so here is that pleural membrane. It's a serous membrane, right? It's got three parts. Here's the visceral right on the surface of the lung. Here's the parietal, which is on the surface of, what's it on the surface of? The thorax, yeah, or thoracic cavity. That's fantastic. And then here is that space, which we call the pleural cavity. Okay. Now, inside the lung, remember, there is surfactant so that the alveoli can inflate. You think it would be a good idea to have surfactant in the pleural cavity? Or would it be good to just have water, which is a glue, which is going to glue your lung to the thorax? Okay, so here is a space where you should not have surfactant. You should actually have just water. So that when you expand your thorax or wall of your thoracic cage, it actually pulls on your lungs as well and expands your lungs. That aids in inspiration. Okay, if the lungs were to detach from the thorax, then somebody couldn't breathe either. Right, so it's good that there's just water. No surfactant in the pleural cavity, but what about inside an alveolus? Surfactant in an alveolus? Absolutely. Okay, so same organ, but that water has to be treated differently depending on where it is. All right, so we've got the parietal pleura, visceral pleura, pleural cavity. Okay, oh, it acts to attach the thoracic cage to the lungs. All right, so we get to talk about mechanics of breathing a little bit. Okay, maybe then some control of respiration. All right, well, here is a pretty good way to think about breathing. And maybe you've seen one of these devices before. It's got a couple little handles on it. Sort of looks like an accordion. Anybody know what an accordion looks like? Okay, you can expand it. It's got all these little ruffles and ridges on it, right? Okay, well, the thing that I'm thinking about has two handles on it, and it's really wide in the back, and on the tip, it's pretty narrow. It's got like a little nozzle, right? And you can work this thing, and it blows air on a fire so that you can get a fire started a little bit more quickly. It's called a bellows, right? A bellows, right? So air goes in and out of a bellows, and when does air go in? When you push the handles together, making the volume inside the bellows smaller, or moving the handles apart, making the volume bigger inside? Yeah, when you make the volume bigger inside, right, when you move the handles apart, that decreases the pressure and air flows into the bellows, right? And when you push the handles together, you're decreasing the volume, and that increases the pressure, and that blows air out. So there's what we call an inverse relationship between volume and pressure, right? So when volume increases, what happens to pressure? It decreases, right? Volume increases, it sucks air in. And when you decrease the volume, what happens to pressure? Remember, it's an inverse relationship. Pressure goes up, goes the other way, right? When you bring the handles together, you decrease the volume, and pressure goes up, and air then exits your body. All right, so think of your lungs kind of as a bellows. So what's really moving air in and out of your lungs is what the size of your thorax or thoracic cage. And what can change the volume or size of your thoracic cage? What can do that? What can move things around in your body, especially your skeleton? Yeah, skeletal muscles. So skeletal muscles are going to be really important for breathing. Well, it's just slightly more complicated than that, but not too much complicated. There are basically two kinds of breathing that we do. Quiet breathing, which is what you're doing right now. And then there's something called forced breathing, and that's sort of like hyperventilation. So under normal circumstances, because right now you're just doing quiet breathing, but what would be some normal circumstances you would do some forced breathing? Like exercise, that's right. Right? So when you use a lot of skeletal muscle, you need a lot more oxygen to make a lot more ATP. We call that forced breathing. So let's think about quiet breathing first. The most important muscle, when we looked at skeletal muscles, we probably did this in lab, is the diaphragm. The diaphragm is the most important muscle for inspiration. Okay. Yeah, that's right here. Now, where do I have that? Relaxation. Okay. So that's pretty much about it. All right, so here I see the diaphragm. Okay, when it contracts, it goes from this dome-shaped structure to a flat structure. So it's just going to go from here to here. And that increases the volume of the thoracic cavity by what I'm circling on the illustration right here. That increases the volume. So when the diaphragm contracts and it moves inferiorly, increasing the volume of the thoracic cavity, what happens to the pressure inside the thoracic cavity? Remember, increasing volume, what happens to pressure? It decreases. All right, so now you have low pressure in your thorax and you still have relatively high pressure in the air. Fluid is going to go from high pressure to low, and air is just going to flow into your thoracic cavity. All right, that's for quiet breathing. The other thing for quiet breathing that we're interested in is expiration. How do we get air out of our lungs? Well, this is kind of funny, right? Quiet breathing, right? Relaxation of the diaphragm. Remember, muscles have elastic properties. And so when the diaphragm relaxes, it goes back to this dome shape. And what happens to the size of the thoracic cavity then? It gets smaller. So as the volume gets smaller, what happens to pressure? It goes up and forces air out of the lungs. So relaxation is something that helps move air out of our lungs for what kind of breathing? Quiet breathing. Okay. Another important thing is, remember those elastic fibers around those alveoli? Okay, for quiet breathing, they are really helpful. They help expel air from your lungs as well. So quiet breathing, expiration is completely passive. It's just a relaxation mode. For inspiration, quiet breathing requires your diaphragm. For expiration, it's just relaxation. Kind of funny that it happens that way. Okay, so that's one. The second kind is forced breathing. There are some other muscles when we have to move a lot of air quickly in and out of our thoracic cavity, like the pectoralis minor. Maybe you have a picture in your mind of pectoralis minor. It helps elevate the rib cage, okay, because it's pulling the ribs up. And then we have, for inspiration, we have the external intercostals, which also help the rib cage elevate and also move out laterally. That increases the volume of the thorax. And sometimes when we're breathing really heavily, the sternocleidomastoids, the serratus anterior, okay, and even the scalenes are important for forced inspiration. So not just the diaphragm, but a whole bunch of other muscles. Okay, now what about expiration? We need to get a lot of air out of the lungs in a hurry. So just by relaxing the diaphragm, that won't move air fast. So we have a couple other muscles that are important for forced expiration. And instead of the external intercostals, the internal intercostals pull the rib cage down and makes the volume smaller. That helps, that's making the bellows smaller. That forces air out of the lungs. And then we have some other muscles that can push a bunch of stuff up into the diaphragm, and that pushes the diaphragm up into the thoracic cavity. What kind of muscles can push stuff that's in your abdominal cavity up into your thorax? Yeah, abdominal muscle. All the abdominal muscles. Rectus abdominis, internal oblique, external oblique, transverse abdominis, right, are synergist muscles for expiration because they help return this diaphragm back to this dome-shaped structure rapidly. Okay, so for forced breathing, it's very active. Both inspiration and expiration require muscles, require energy. For quiet breathing, only inspiration requires energy. Expiration is completely passive, right? Completely passive. Doesn't require any energy. And that's what you're doing right now, is quiet breathing. So you could just all relax. What are you going to hear if everybody just relaxes? Yeah, everybody's just going to sigh, right? Just by relaxing. Okay. Gas exchange, we talked about this a little bit, right? About 300 million alveoli, about 70 square meters, about half a tennis court. All right, so the surface area for exchange is 70 square meters. What should you think of that as? A doorway, right? So that's a huge doorway for exchange. All right, we talked about the respiratory membrane. The only thing I include that's a little bit different than your book, right? Your book says the wall of the capillary, that interstitial space, and the wall of the alveolus, but I also include surfactant, a layer of surfactant on the inside of the alveolus, because I don't want you to forget about that. Right? But that's a very microscopic, that's just a molecular layer, so most people don't include that as part of the respiratory membrane, but don't forget about it. All right, control of respiration. It's very important. The medulla oblongata and pons. I think you probably know where the medulla and pons are, right? The medulla is right on top of the spinal cord, and right above that is the pons. There are some nuclei responsible for breathing. And one of those kind of acts like a pacemaker. Your heart has a pacemaker. Oh, and you got to know what that is. What's the pacemaker in the heart called? Yeah, the sinoatrial node. It has rhythmicity all by itself, right? And there is a nucleus inside the pons that does that. And then there are a couple other nucleuses or nuclei inside the medulla that can adjust the rate of the pacemaker. And I think that's pretty much all I want you to know about that. Most important thing, the respiratory center is in the medulla and pons, right? And that's the brain stem. All right, so there are outputs of that respiratory center to the diaphragm, and you should know the name of the nerve from the medulla down to the diaphragm. Okay, actually it doesn't come from the medulla. Medulla sends signals down into the spinal cord, and it leaves the spinal cord, and then it goes to the diaphragm. So it's not a cranial nerve. Okay, and the name of that nerve, the phrenic nerve, and it gets nerves from a couple places in the vertebral column. And you should know what levels of the vertebral column that nerve originates from. There's a nerve plexus that's involved. C, the cervical, yeah, cervical, even though your diaphragm's way down here, it's in the cervical region. C3, C4, and C5. Right, so that's important to know. And there's, what's that little saying that will help you remember? C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive because that's what innervates the phrenic nerve, which innervates the diaphragm, which is what? The most important muscle for inspiration. Okay. Well, your respiratory rate has to be regulated based on the demands of your body and the internal environment of chemicals inside your body. So some important ones will be carbon dioxide, some will be oxygen, and also some will be the acidity inside your body. What's a measure of acidity? Don't talk about this at all, but in chemistry you do. It is pH, right? pH is a measure of acidity inside your body. These things will adjust respiratory rate. And I think I want to finish it up next time, even though there's some fun things to talk about here. I'm going to finish this up next time. Okay, how CO2, oxygen, and pH regulate respiratory rate without your conscious thought. Okay, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Did I pass it around? Yeah, I think I did. Your name might not be on there, but just sign the back of that one last paper. Okay, see you guys up in lab.